Well, good evening, everybody. This evening's reading is from Exodus chapter 20, and I'm going to get the verse for you in a moment, 16. But don't bother turning to it because it's only one verse, and it says this: "You shall not give false testimony against your neighbor." I might even read it twice because it's so short, just in case you missed it the first time. "You shall not give false testimony against your neighbor." And then the second reading is from James chapter 3, beginning at verse 1. If you are following, that's on page 1214, slightly longer. It's quite tricky to read this, actually. "Not many of you should presume to be teachers, my brothers, because you know that we who teach will be judged more strictly. We all stumble in many ways. If anyone is never at fault in what he says, he is a perfect man, able to keep his whole body in check. When we put bits into the mouths of horses to make them obey us, we can turn the whole animal. Or take ships as an example. Although they're so large and are driven by strong winds, they're steered by a very small rudder wherever the pilot wants to go. Likewise, the tongue is a small part of the body, but it makes great boasts. Consider what a great forest is set on fire by a small spark. The tongue is also a fire, a world of evil among the parts of the body. It corrupts the whole person, sets the whole course of his life on fire, and it is itself set on fire by hell. All kinds of animals, birds, reptiles, and creatures of the sea are being tamed and have been tamed by man, but no man can tame the tongue. It's a restless evil full of deadly poison. With the tongue we praise our Lord and Father, and with it we curse men who have been made in God's likeness. Out of the same mouth come praise and cursing. My brothers, this should not be. Can both fresh water and salt water flow from the same spring?" This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Just hearing what Linwin was saying about coming back from New Wine, I can assure you that I was not driving back from New Wine last weekend saying, "Lord, please, please let me preach a sermon on lying. Please let me help people, let me tell people actually how to behave." These words from James are strong, aren't they? They're difficult in some senses to hear. And for someone who has a role in teaching, particularly quite tricky to read out loud to other people. And I want to say that everything that is said this evening is said in humility. We are in this together, and I hope you share that same perspective, that we are in this together. And there is no "thou shall" or "thou shalt not" that I can say. All of those "thou shalls" and "thou shalt nots" are the only person who can say those is God. And so we are all under his authority this evening. In 1993... Microsoft released its first version of Encarta. Now, half of you are thinking, "My goodness me, is that really 22 years ago?" And the other half of you are thinking, "What on earth is Encarta?" Microsoft Encarta was, for its day, an incredibly powerful and extensive tool. It was just in that little bit before widespread use of the internet. And so Microsoft came up with this online encyclopedia. It was a wealth of information on anything and everything. But in this first edition, in the first day that it was released, there were 9 versions of it. There were 9 versions because they had an American version, a British version, French, German, Italian, Spanish, Dutch, Japanese, and Brazilian. Now, it wasn't just that each version was written in a different language. There were actually nuances in the editing of the text, of the entries about different things, as you would look up in an encyclopedia. And the director of Microsoft was quoted as saying this: "If you look at the Battle of Waterloo in the English Encarta and in the French Encarta, you get 2 very different versions of things like, say, who won the battle? If you're French, we can have that debate a little bit later. In the story of Holy Week, in John chapter 18, Jesus is sent, as you will have celebrated on Easter, Jesus is sent to Pontius Pilate. He's the local Roman governor. And things are looking a bit desperate. Pilate really wants to get to the bottom of this situation. You'll know his situation. He's uncomfortable. He doesn't actually think Jesus is guilty of anything. But what he really wants to do is get to the bottom of his identity. And it is really key because the charges against him are all about who he says he is. And so Jesus mentions his kingdom, and Pilate jumps on that answer. It's a really dramatic part of the text of the scripture. And in verse 37, Pilate says, "You are a king then?" Jesus answered, "You say that I am a king. In fact, the reason I was born and came into the world is to testify to the truth. Everyone on the side of truth listens to me." And I stand by Pilate in what he said next, because that's a bit confusing to me too. You can hear the exasperation in Pilate's voice. "What is truth?" retorted Pilate. "What is truth?" I wonder if you can feel Pilate's frustration. That agonizing question echoes down through all of the ages to us. What is truth? Jesus was standing there in front of him. Jesus, who a little time before in John's gospel had described himself as the way, the truth, and the life. He's standing there in front of Pilate, and yet Pilate has heard so many different perspectives, so many nuances, so many objectives, and in some cases so many blatant lies that he finds it impossible to identify the truth, even though it's standing there right in front of him. And my sense for us today is that we live in a world where it's difficult to know what is truth. What's true? We live in a society where most things are relative. Like those encyclopedia entries, one person's truth is another person's fact, is another person's opinion, is another person's nuance. And dare we say it, is another person's lie. And not only is it as relativism made it difficult to discern what is true, but more than that, it's made truth deeply unpopular. It's not fashionable to declare something true or untrue. You see, with the advent of that unprecedented access that we have to such a world of information, moved on in so many ways from that basic encyclopedia in Carter 22 years ago, that we now have such confidence in our own opinions that they become our truth. Don't know if you remember back to the 1998 album, the Manic Street Preachers had their finger right on the point when they released their fifth album called "This Is My Truth, Now Tell Me Yours." I went yesterday with my family to the newly refurbished Reigate Cinema, which was very nice. If you haven't been, it's very flash and fancy. Do recommend it as a day out or an afternoon out. And we went to see Inside Out. Has anyone seen Inside Out yet? It's the new Disney Pixar. No, actually, this is the evening service, isn't it? Silly me. If I'd asked that in the morning, there'd have been hands everywhere. Oh, hands at the back. Yes, we went to see Inside Out. As I say, latest offering from Disney Pixar. And I won't give too much of the story away because you might find yourself somehow watching a Disney film. But it's about the human emotions. And actually, all the characters, the main characters, are the human emotions as they operate inside the body. So we've got Joy, who's a lovely sort of floaty, lovely girl person. She's like the main character. And then we've got sadness, fear, disgust, and anger, who blows his top all the time. He's got fire on top of his head. It's great. And at one point in the film, one of the characters inside this human body where the story is set spills a wheelbarrow full of bricks. And half of these bricks are labelled facts, and half of these bricks are labelled opinions. And before the spillage, on this sort of trailer thing that he's got, they're all neatly divided. So the facts are on one side of the trailer, and the opinions are on the other. But because this character is in a hurry, and after the spillage, he hasn't got time, he simply sweeps all of the bricks in together, facts and opinions all muddled up in the wheelbarrow. Now, I'm not sure that my six-year-old son quite got the nuance, quite got the point, but actually I think it was profound what the filmmakers were trying to say there, that within us, facts and opinions have been merged into the same thing in some cases, and often it's difficult to tell the difference between the two. And so as we come to this particular part of the Ten Commandments, did you notice, not commandments this evening, but commandments, I'm really glad that the Reigate effect is wearing off and someone's learning to speak properly at last. As we come to this particular part of the Ten Commandments, where God tells his people, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. Well, in a relative world where opinions and objective truth often become muddled, we might think it rather a minefield, mightn't we, to try and keep this commandment. We might even wonder if it's necessary. I mean, if everything is relative and every opinion is valid as the next opinion, well, if there's no such thing as absolute truth anymore, then do I really need to worry about holding to the truth? Is it a bit outdated? Is this now a bit old-fashioned? Well, there are many different forms of lying, aren't there? Even as I use that word out loud in front of you, it makes me feel uncomfortable. We don't often say that word anymore. We don't often talk about lying. We talk about being mistaken. We talk about holding a different opinion. We even talk about being economical with the truth. The most blatant form, of course, is a total lie, a complete and utter fabrication of what did or didn't happen. Now, my hunch is that pretty much everybody, I think everybody in this room, would reject outright lying as something we avoid doing. Great, that's a good thing. But there are, of course, much more subtle ways in which we are drawn in to this lying business. We're drawn in to tempted not to tell the truth. J. John, in his book about the Ten Commandments, gives an example of leaving the office door unlocked when everyone's gone home. Now, if we knew it was our responsibility to lock it, and we say, I did lock it, and someone else must have opened it, that's the blatant lie, isn't it? But what about if we remain silent? Who didn't lock the office door? And you don't say anything. There's a sense in which that's a lie. And he goes on to say there's also the misleading hint. And his example, we don't actually state the lie, but we assemble the pieces which allow somebody else to come to the wrong conclusion. So with the example of the office door, we might casually mention that one of the new admin staff has been very preoccupied lately. Oh, and she left in a hurry last night. Perhaps we can be comfortable there that we didn't tell a lie, but someone else jumped to the wrong conclusion. Sorry, folks, it's still lying. Then there's exaggeration, overstating a case to make a point. When I was at New Wine last week, there were literally millions of women in the queue for the toilet, and I was waiting for hours. Actually, there were about 10 people in the queue, and it took several minutes to get to the front. It's still a lie. And then there's deception. And the worst kind of deception is self-deception. There's a real danger in the form of lying that deceives even ourselves of who we really are. You might say that the worst lie you can tell is one that you tell to yourself. Whether it's a lie to make us feel better about ourselves, or, as I think is becoming more common, the lies we begin to believe about ourselves that we're not good enough, or that nobody loves us, or that we don't deserve to have good friends and such things. We lie to ourselves, we mislead ourselves, however we want to phrase it, in all kinds of different ways. And as we worry more and more and more about what people think of us, especially in the advent of social media, there are ever more and more ways to present ourselves to others in ways which may or may not be truthful. And so I come back to that question I asked at the beginning. Does it matter? Does it matter if the concept of truth is slipping from our shared grasp? Is there really a cost to lying in all its many and varied forms? And the answer is, of course, yes, there is. Do you know, at the most basic, the financial costs of lying are astonishing. If you look at the numbers to do with fraudulent insurance claims or benefit claims that run into millions of pounds every year, and now such people as insurance companies build into our premiums extra cost because they take into account the number of claims every year they will have to settle that are fabricated or not true. There is a financial cost, very basically, to lying. But I think even more important than that, what of the concept of trust, which goes hand in hand with truth? How much do you believe what politicians tell you now, since the advent of marketing gurus and spin doctors? I think it seems that we believe less and less of the words spoken by those in authority. Every time the electorate, the public, hear phrases like, "I did not have inappropriate relations with that woman," or "there are weapons of mass destruction which can be activated in 45 minutes, or "we will make sure that those on the margins of society are properly cared for," and it turns out not to be true, a little more of the shared trust for those in authority is chipped away. Expenses scandals and the like do nothing to help. It's very easy to be critical of those in authority, but it's not just, is it, at a governmental level that this is a problem. Our most basic social relations are founded on openness and trust, and where lying of whatever form prevails, our relationships are damaged and do not last long. This ninth commandment that we come to today tackles that whole issue of truth and lies, particularly as they affect those around us. You see, it doesn't just give us an intellectual rule that truth is good and truth is right. It says, you shall not give false testimony about your neighbour. Our use or abuse of truth affects our relationships with others. Lies hurt people. God, the founder of community, the founder of human relationships, the founder of love, knew that for those things to flourish, we must be able to trust each other. And so we come back to that dilemma. We live in an age of relativism where absolute truth is often shunned. Is it possible to be countercultural? Is it possible to be people of truth who do not give false testimony about either ourselves or about our neighbour? Is it possible to believe there's absolute truth? Is it possible still to cling on to that higher moral code that can be followed? Or is my code my truth and your code your truth? Is it all too old-fashioned and past its sell-by date? The simplicity of saying to myself as I walk out of here, I'm going to be more truthful, or I must not tell lies, which we might write in lines at secondary school, does not, in our complex society, take us far enough in working out how to be people of truth in a relative world. It takes more effort than ever to be people of integrity and people of truth. But there are a couple of suggestions that I want to offer to help us make a start in this area. The first one is, be open. Be open. In our own lives, why don't we just try to resist that urge to cover up, to blame others, to sweep things under the carpet, to have secrets? I'm not saying for a moment that we all hang all our dirty laundry out in public all the time. But one of the traditions of the Christian community through the centuries, and even still today, is to have a person or a group of people with whom we can be brutally honest and who have permission, this is very important, who have permission to ask us difficult and searching questions. When we practice such deep honesty and openness in these kind of settings, it releases us to be freer and more open in other areas of life. I'm in a prayer triplet with two ladies I was with at theological college with. And actually in Reigate, I pray with two other women as well. And they all have permission to ask me difficult questions, and I have the permission to do the same with them. I also have a responsibility to listen, and that takes time and it takes investment. But if you would call yourself a Christian and you don't have that kind of relationship anywhere where you can be totally honest, I would really encourage you to think about that. And actually, more than that, I would encourage you to take action on it. It's really important. Either come to me to talk about a small group, or take the initiative and ask two or three other people to join in with you to talk, to listen to each other. That's really important, to ask questions and to pray. It's such a powerful thing to do. And not least in being open people who become used to telling the truth about ourselves and our situations. So firstly, let's be people who are open. And secondly, seek to behave with integrity. Now, this is not a surprise, is it, for us to talk about in church? Let's try and be people of integrity. But as people of truth, we are called to be people of our word. Jesus encouraged his followers to keep their word whatever the cost. In Matthew 5:37, he famously says that your yes should be yes and your no should be no. You shouldn't need to say anything dramatic like, I swear on my mother's grave that it's true. Or you don't need to say anything like that. As people get to know you, they will know that your average comment, whatever you say, can be trusted because you are a person of integrity. And as you go out to your workplace or your school or in your community, in your toddler group or whatever it is, that stands out like a candle in the darkness when you are a person of the truth. And thankfully, in this room, I don't know everybody that well, but in this room, there are many people who I would put in that category. And lastly, let's not be afraid of absolute truth. Let's not be afraid to confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, because all your hope and your security is in that absolute truth. And if you fully and completely believe that Jesus died for you because he loves you, and that he rose again, and that he conquered death, and now that he stands in heaven praying constantly for you, then have confidence. Now, we don't need to ram our faith down the throats of other people. There's a whole thing we could say there about evangelism. But on the other hand, we do not need to be afraid. And I think actually we're quite the opposite. We actually have something really appealing to offer. Because my sense is that there are folks out there who find life really tricky without this kind of framework, without a sense of truth, without some benchmarks to cling on to. I don't know if you've ever seen or read Harry Potter, particularly if you've seen the film and you've seen the hallway in Hogwarts. I don't know if you've seen that. The staircases move, and you can start at the bottom of a staircase. It's a magical school, and you can start at the bottom of a staircase, and halfway up it can begin to move, and it can take you somewhere completely different. And not only that, but when the staircases start moving, certainly in the film they portray this, there isn't always a handrail to hold on to. And so if you're standing in the middle of this stone staircase, it can be a bit dicey trying to stay upright. We live in a world where the staircases or the goalposts keep moving. I submit that we live in a world where people aren't sure what's expected of them, and where many feel like the ground is moving a bit too fast. But we have access to the most solid handrail there has ever been. In this age, the church, and by the church I don't mean that group of people over there, I mean you and me, we have so much to say to bring relief from that uncertainty and that movement and that instability that faces our societies. So let's not bear false witness against ourselves or our neighbour. Let's together be people who are known for bearing true witness, not only to ourselves, not only to our neighbour, but to the one who makes the ground solid beneath our feet, who can make sense of life when we have muddled up fact and opinion, and who loves us so much that we can be confident to declare his name, Jesus, the way, the truth, and the life.